conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about a painting that is arguably the most famous painting in all of American art. And the painting we're talking about is Grant Wood's American Gothic. Folks in the art world this summer are celebrating the 75th birthday of this painting. There are now a couple of books out discussing it, talking a little bit about its history, talking about the various ways that people have reacted to the painting over time, how that has changed, and why it is that this image has become such an iconic image for us. And we'll be talking about those very issues this morning in this part of Focus 580 as we talk with Stephen Beal. He is the director of the History and Literature Program at Harvard University and is the author of the recently published book, American Gothic, A Life of America's Most Famous Painting. It's published by W.W. Norton, and we're glad to have him talking with us this morning. He is also the author of another book. We actually discussed this book on the program when it was first published back in 1996. That book is Down with the Old Canoe, A Cultural History of the Titanic Disaster, a book that is still in print. It's available in paperback. It's published by W.W. Norton. So if that sounds interesting to you, you can take a look at it. And of course, the new book, American Gothic, is out now in bookstores. Stephen Beal is joining us this morning from Harvard by a high-quality ISDN connection. We're pleased that we can do it that way, and our thanks to the folks there at Harvard. And also for people who are listening this morning, as always, questions are welcome. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do have that toll-free line as well. That's 800-222-9455. At any point here, people have questions, they're welcome to call. Mr. Beal, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we certainly appreciate you giving us your time. I expect that there are a handful of works of art have been created different places, different times, that are very well known, that are known everywhere, and that have been frequently copied and frequently parodied. I think it's probably safe to say that of all American works, the most copied, the most parodied, perhaps the best known, is this painting that we're talking about. You think that's a fair assertion?
I think that's fair. A close second, I would say, is Whistler's Mother, but maybe not so close after all.
Hmm. Perhaps we'll just plunge right in and talk a little bit about the creation of the painting. And I guess one of the things that I learned from looking at the book that I think is interesting is that while the thing that strikes us about the painting are the two individuals, that in fact Grant Wood started with the house.
That's right. I don't know that there's any painting in world art as famous as this one that has such humble origins. The origins of the painting are that Grant Wood was a struggling artist, virtually unknown outside of Cedar Rapids, Iowa. He went down to a small town in south central Iowa called Eldon because a friend of his was running an outreach program in community fine arts down there. And Wood went on a ride with a younger painter named John Sharp around the outskirts of Eldon, and they happened upon this house. And Wood was struck by this anomalous Gothic window in this otherwise a very modest and tiny house. And he said, "Stop the car. I want to paint this." And he had his paints along, and he sketched the house on the spot. And then he went back home to Cedar Rapids. And he had come up with the idea that he would find some figures to put in front of it that would somehow match the character of the house. Eventually, he settled upon his dentist, Dr. Byron McKeeby, who was in his 60s at the time. And after struggling a bit, having a model in mind but being afraid to ask her, he finally settled on his sister, Nan Wood. And those are the figures that we now know so well. He did a number of things to change the house. In the final painting, he elongated the gable and the Gothic window. But if you go down to Eldon, there it is. It's still there.
And you have a couple of pictures of the book in the house, of the house in the book, and it is indeed a very humble structure. You might, and I'm sure so many people have passed by it, not really thinking much of anything about it. Probably the, as you say, probably the most remarkable thing about it, or the thing that if anything is going to catch your eye, it is that arched window that's up on the second story of the house.
That's right. I don't think you could. Eldon is not a place that you would be likely just to pass through and not notice the house. I think if you were in Eldon, there are enough signs there that would direct you to the house at this point. And I think you would probably only go to Eldon now to look at the house if you had that in your plans or anyway.
Mm-hmm. And this is this house is on the National Register of Historic Places.
It is, and at the time that I finished the book, there had been long-term plans that had never come to fruition to create a visitor center on the site. There's a sign there marking it, and they get a handful of tourists probably coming through every day. But they were having trouble locally raising the money to match the state funds for the visitor center. But just this summer, they did come up with the money through a pretty strenuous fundraising effort. So apparently groundbreaking is in the near future for a visitor center there.
Yeah. As you mentioned, the man in the picture, there were two real models for these two individuals. The man in the picture was Grant Wood's family dentist, and the woman is Grant Wood's, the artist's sister. Had she posed before for him? I'm sure the dentist had no modeling experience before, but had his sister?
She had she was not entirely thrilled with being with modeling in this form as a rather dowdy, as she described it, kind of maidenish old maid in this. So he painted a fairly glamorous portrait of her called Portrait of Nan shortly after, where she's in modern clothes. Her hair isn't tied up behind her. There's a much more pleasant expression on her face. I think that was his gift to her after having her pose in this rather grim way in American Gothic.
Mm. The two of them, despite what one I suppose might imagine, did not pose together when the painting was done. They were done. Grant Wood had them did the work and posed them in two different places. And the two of them actually never really got together until 1942. And there's a picture in the book here where the two of them, Nan Wood Graham and Byron McKeeby, are standing next to the painting in the Art Institute. And it's funny because apparently Wood said to them, as a way of trying to encourage them, particularly, I guess, the dentist, to pose for the painting, he said, well, I'll change it so nobody will recognize you. Nobody will know that it's you. Well, I'm sorry, but I see these two people standing next to the painting, and particularly Dr. McCreeby, but also Nan, the artist's sister, it does indeed look like them.
They're pretty unmistakable. Mm-hmm. That's true. Mm-hmm. He did change them a bit, but whether he was being disingenuous in saying that, or just he really believed that he changed their looks and expressions enough, I'm not sure. But if you look at that photo of them posing together, actually for the first time in 1942, 12 years after it was painted, you know who they are.
Yeah. I have a caller here I would get right to. Let me just ask one more question. And of course, there are a lot of other things that we can talk about here. But among the various questions that you wonder about when you look at this painting and you look at the various details of the painting, I guess one of the things you think of is, why the pitchfork? Why, as he was posing the two figures, why did he make that decision to have the man holding the pitchfork like that?
Well, after he sketched the house, he did a pencil sketch where he did put two figures into it, and the man is holding, in that version, he's holding a rake. So the pitchfork wasn't there from the beginning. Some kind of tool was, but then Wood said that the decision for the pitchfork was an aesthetic decision, because it mirrors the arched windows, and it also then mirrors a pattern in the man's overalls. Now, lots of people haven't taken that comment at face value at all. They've read lots of meanings into the pitchfork. And I should also say that Wood took a lot of heat for calling it a pitchfork and for it having three tines, because a number of people said, well, pitchforks have four tines. He said, no, it really was a three-tine pitchfork, which I've now learned is actually a hay fork. It's used for pitching hay.
Hmm. But it was actually a real thing, and when he painted when he posed the model, did he indeed say, give him this thing and say, here, hold, stand it like this, hold this, and there, so there was a real object that the man was holding?
There was a real three-tine fork, yes.
Our guest at this part of Focus 580 is Stephen Beal. He's director of the History and Literature Program at Harvard University and has authored a new book that looks at the painting American Gothic, how it was created, and how over time the reaction to the painting has changed, how certainly people have reacted to it different ways over time, have read many, many different meanings into it, how that has changed, and also, in fact, how the painter himself, Grant Wood, over time has said a lot of different things about the painting and what it was that he had in mind saying by the painting. The book is published by W.W. Norton and is out now. We do have a caller here, someone who's been patiently waiting, and we'll get to them, and they're listening this morning in Kankakee on our Line 4 toll-free line. Hello.
Thank you, David Inch, for having Stephen Beal as a guest on Focus 580. And thank you, Stephen Beal, for producing American Gothic, A Life of America's Most Famous Painting. This book is a profusely illustrated volume with 8 pages of color plates, including the artist's sketch of the home made on the site in Eldon, Iowa, and very many black and white photographs, cartoons, and images. Your caller hopes that many will travel on the Amtrak California Zephyr to Ottumwa, Iowa, the station closest to Eldon, Iowa, the site of the house which sets the scene of the celebrated portrait of Nan Wood Graham and Byron McKeeby. Transmuting the field of dreams, if you build it, he will come theme, your caller now would suggest that since you have seen it, they will come. Grant Wood saw it, now Stephen Beal has seen it, and Eldon, Iowa can expect visitors. One of your chapters considers American Gothic as icon, and your caller wonders if this direction could not be pursued to the point where one could say that American Gothic is best understood as something very close to Byzantine icon. Were Nan looking at us, and could Nan be inscribed Holy Nan, and Byron inscribed Holy Byron, we are presented with icon in this sense. Doesn't one see something very close to Byzantine icon in El Greco? And doesn't one see something very close to El Greco in American Gothic? And is not what we have here not satire or comedy, not Green Acres or Beverly Hillbillies, but something very close to Byzantine icon?
Well, your comment, I think, indicates the range of possibilities of this complex painting. When I talk about it as an icon, as you know, I talk about it as a national icon, that these figures over time came to be construed as representative Americans, as emblems of wholesomeness and steadfastness and virtue. And that's what I mean by icon. But no doubt, Wood was well-versed in art history, and people have talked about more immediate influences. He took several trips to Europe in the 1920s. Flemish art was a significant influence on him. But I would be surprised if he wasn't aware of other artistic influences, too.
While we have you, would you also tell us something of another of your books, Independent Intellectuals in the United States? Thank you.
All right. Well,
sure.
You want to do that?
I'd be glad to. Thank you for noticing that book. That book is 13 years old now, and it's about intellectuals, critics who worked outside of universities, who tried to make a living being intellectuals, which was a hard thing in the first half of the 20th century, which was what I wrote about, and it's an even harder thing to do now. But interestingly, a few of the figures whom I talked about in that book actually come up in American Gothic, particularly H.L. Mencken, who was a significant influence, I say, on Grant Wood and also on the initial reception of American Gothic. Mencken was a kind of a vehement critic of small town and rural life in the 1920s. He was widely read. He was snide. He thought that the Midwest and the South were bastions of self-righteousness and Puritanism and general nastiness. And the painting was initially understood in that way. It was understood as satirizing, if not ridiculing, the people whom it portrayed.
Let's talk some more about the reaction to the painting, because initially it was controversial, and I think perhaps for a number of reasons, but you've just touched on one, is that people, particularly Iowans, I guess, people thought that Grant Wood was making fun of them, which apparently was not Grant Wood's intention at all. At least I don't believe that that was his intention, but that's the way a lot of people took it, as a satirical comment on Midwesterners and Midwestern life.
That's right. The thing that really hooked me onto this topic was discovering that people were offended by it initially. I can understand why certain parodies have offended people over the years, but it was harder for me to understand why people would have been offended by the original. There are these wonderful letters that some Iowa farm wives wrote to the Des Moines Register soon after the painting was printed in newspapers in Iowa and across the country, really objecting to this as a very negative portrayal of rural life and of them in particular. They really thought that the woman in the painting was supposed to be an Iowa farm wife, that she was represented as being self-righteous and kind of backward-looking and grim and mean and nasty, and they didn't like that at all.
It's interesting there. You touch on another one of the reactions to the painting that apparently got people upset. They looked at the painting and thought that this was intended to show a married couple, a man and his wife. And Grant Wood apparently didn't have that in mind. He thought that he was presenting a picture of a man and his daughter. Is that right?
Well, we don't really know what Grant Wood intended at all for this painting, since he didn't leave any letters that I've turned up or any comments from before he painted it. So everything that we know about what Grant Wood said about the painting is after it struck this initial controversy. So there's a kind of defensiveness to his initial remarks about it, an understandable defensiveness since he was being attacked for it by his fellow Iowans. And he variously said over the years that they were supposed to be father and daughter, and that they were supposed to be husband and wife. He didn't say definitively one way or another what the relationship was supposed to be. His sister, though, was adamant that they were father and daughter, not husband and wife. And I think there was a personal reason for that, namely that she was in her 30s when she posed and Dr. McKeeby was in his 60s, and the thought of being married to Dr. McKeeby or somebody that old was rather unsettling to her.
One of the things obvious things that you notice when you look at the painting is that the man is looking at you. He's looking at the viewer directly. He's engaging you directly. The woman is not. She's looking off to the side. I wonder what Grant Wood said, or if he said anything about that.
I don't think that I've come across any specific comment by Grant Wood about that, about why she's not looking directly at us and he is. But the fact that she is looking off to the side gives the whole painting a sort of obliqueness and a certain mystery, even a haunting quality, depending on how you look at it, that in any event, that and other things about the painting have made all these different interpretations over the years possible. If it were just a sort of straightforward, we know what this is kind of image, it wouldn't have the history that it does.
The other thing that just strikes me looking at it, and here now I'm looking at the reproduction of the painting that's in the book, so I'm not standing in front of the painting but I'm looking at the one here, is that there's a significant difference to me in the way that the bodies and the clothing of the two individuals are painted, in the sense that the man his clothing looks a little bit more real. There is a little bit more in the way of depth and detail to what he's wearing, and the woman almost looks like a paper doll. What she looks like, she's flat, and he looks like he has dimension. Is the actual painting like that?
There is a degree of that. The amount of detail that went into this is extraordinary, and I'm not an artist, and for that matter, I'm not an art historian, but it's a painstaking piece. It took him intense work to do this. But I think it's fair to say that what you see in the reproductions, you also see in the original, that there's more detail, there's more attention to the man, particularly the man's clothes, than to the woman's. But also and this may just have to do with the models, I don't know. His face is more deeply contoured. He's older, so he has wrinkles, and that may have a lot to do with it. But I do think that there's more realism to his face than there is to hers.
Yeah, and it also the lighting is slightly different. It looks as if there is a strong light that's coming from, say, their upper right, that's shining across, particularly across her face, as it's not straight on, and not so much in his. So I suppose that might also be a function of the fact that she's kind of turned three quarters and he's full face.
Right. A bit more of her face is in shadow than his is.
Our guest, let me just quickly introduce again our guest, Stephen Beal. He is the director of the History and Literature Program at Harvard University and is author of a new book that's titled American Gothic, A Life of America's Most Famous Painting, and it's published by W.W. Norton. 75 years ago this summer, Grant Wood created this painting, and it's been making an impression on people ever since. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. This painting now hangs in the Art Institute in Chicago and is probably one of the most popular, most viewed works in the whole museum. It may be the number one, although they have a lot of pretty well-known Impressionist paintings and paintings by Georgia O'Keeffe and a number of artists. So there are a lot of really significant works to be seen. But I'm sure this is probably one of those that draws lots and lots of people. It was entered into a competition there in Chicago when it was painted by Grant Wood. And I guess the reaction to some people to the painting right away was not particularly positive. And in fact, some people thought that we should just crate this thing up and send it back to Iowa. They didn't even want to put it on display.
That's right. I mentioned its humble origins a few minutes ago and talking about Wood being an unknown artist and coming from Iowa, and it being this kind of accidental encounter between Wood and this house in Eldon, Iowa. But its origins are also humble in the sense that it could easily have been sent back to Iowa and never seen by anybody except Wood and his family and friends. He did enter it into the annual competition of the Art Institute in the late summer or early fall of 1930, just after it had been painted. And it won third prize. From there, some influential art critics really embraced it, reprinted it in newspapers. It took off across the country, and its fame was almost instantaneous. What a great story that I found when I was doing research at the Art Institute is that a trustee at the time wrote several years later a letter in which he said that Wood's painting wasn't supposed to even win third prize, that he had seen it in a pile of discarded canvases. And he went to the jury's chairman and he said, what about this one? I think you passed this over. And the jury's chairman called it, that comic Valentine, a very dismissive kind of evaluation of it. But the trustee persisted, and the rest is history.
Mm-hmm. We talked about the fact that the way that people have viewed this painting over time has changed and has been contentious, and that people have seen it both as they've seen it as an attack on rural people and rural life. They've seen it as a celebration of rural people and rural life. And initially, there was a pretty strong negative reaction, at least among Native Iowans, to the painting for a couple of reasons, but perhaps chiefly because they thought that it was satirical, that Grant Wood, in fact, was making fun of them or making a negative comment. And I suppose that over time, you know, both of those things have been people have seen that in the paintings, that it is a lampoon on one sense, or a kind of a tribute, an icon, to use that word in all its forms, in the other. Was there some point, though, in the trajectory of how people have looked at the painting, that there was a turnaround where it went from being mostly negative to mostly positive, or has this sort of mixed feeling, that is, you know, one way or another, has that always kind of been mixed overall when you look at what people have thought about the picture?
No, I don't think so. I think there was a decisive turn, and it happened fairly quickly, and it happened in the context of the 1930s. This painting, coming as it did in 1930, appeared really at the onset of the Great Depression, and I think the context of the Depression had a dramatic effect in altering how people perceived and understood it. So that while the farm wives and other Iowans objected to it as being satirical, initially the critics who liked it also saw it as satirical. They read it the same. They viewed it the same way. In effect, they thought that this was a kind of, you know, Mencken-esque Sinclair Lewis kind of debunking or send up of self-righteous Midwestern kind of Bible thumping Puritans. Within 3 or 4 years, you start to see a really decisive shift. So that Wood is not only being celebrated as a great Native artist by his fellow Iowans, but even East Coast critics now come to see, whether they like Wood or not, they come to see this as a sort of celebration of the American folk, of the people, and from being figures that we aren't supposed to identify with, we're supposed to kind of laugh at, they become figures whom we're supposed to look up to.
We talked a little bit earlier, maybe people who didn't hear at the beginning of the program, that the two models for the two characters in the painting were the artist's sister and the artist's dentist, and that one of the things that Wood apparently had said to them was, in trying to encourage them to pose, was that, well, I'll make some changes in the faces of these people, and no one will ever know that it's you. We also talked about how if you see, and there is indeed a photograph of the two of them later, many years later, standing by the painting, and there's not much doubt who it is, who these people are. You also talked about the fact that the artist, as a bit of a compensation to his sister, afterward painted a more glamorous painting of her, making her more attractive, perhaps doing a little justice and redressing what he did to her in this other picture. Having said all that, did the two of them, did they have a particular feeling about the fact that at some level, this painting did indeed make them famous?
Well, Nan Wood is an extraordinary character. She lived much, much longer than her brother, who died in 1942, only 12 years after American Gothic was painted. Nan Wood Graham lived till 1990, and needless to say, her identification with this painting went on and on and grew greater and stronger over the years, not to mention her kind of protection of her brother's legacy. She was extraordinarily dedicated to preserving his reputation and enhancing his reputation. But she was also very protective of herself and her image, to the extent that when in the late 60s Johnny Carson showed a parody of American Gothic with a woman in a bikini and Playboy, a letter writer to Playboy from Champaign, Illinois, actually sent in his own parody of American Gothic, not in a bikini this time, but topless. Nan Wood Graham sued Playboy and Johnny Carson for defamation, claiming that everybody knows that she's the woman who posed and that this defamed her. And she won a small out-of-court settlement for it, but she was extremely protective of Wood and of that image. Hmm.
Well, that gets to the issue of, and we talked a little bit earlier about how often it's been copied and parodied, and probably in all of American art there would only be one other painting that could come close, which would be Whistler's Mother. If you take two people and you pose them, you know, a man and a woman together like that, and you have the man hold something, it wouldn't even have to be two men. It wouldn't even have to be two people. That we know that image so well, if you get something close to that pose, we'll connect that with this painting, which makes you wonder, even at the point where someone could have claimed rights to the image, to what extent you could ever enforce something like that, control how that image is used. And in fact, today, I don't know who, if the Art Institute owns it because they own the painting, or if anybody owns it, so that you could have some kind of control over what you do with it.
Well, the Art Institute and an organization called the Visual Artists and Galleries Association jointly control rights to American Gothic, and they do try to enforce their intellectual property in it, so that if American Gothic is used in an advertisement, they expect one to pay for it and clear permissions for it. But there's no doubt that there are many, many hundreds, if not thousands, of takeoffs on American Gothic that they haven't tracked down or haven't been able to find the perpetrators of. Mm-hmm. And it's widely reproduced without copyright clearance.
Sure. And even so, you have some of them in the book, some wonderful takeoffs on the painting, some that from movie advertisements. Here's one that's a cover of the Saturday Evening Post with the Beverly Hillbillies. There's one that was a cover of a comedy record that shows LBJ and Lady Bird. There's one with Bill and Hillary Clinton. It's one that's particularly striking that is Paris Hilton and Nicole Richie from this something that Fox did to promote this goofy television show that they did where they sent them out to live on a farm. And it's the two of them standing there in party garb. And Nicole is holding the pitchfork and Paris is holding her little dog. And even there, you know, of course, what the reference is. Now, I don't know if that's far enough away from the original so that you can say, there's nothing you can do about that. But very clearly, again, when you see that setup, you know exactly what it is that's being referred to.
Right. Well, that's the argument for enforcing copyright protection on it, is that the parody wouldn't work if it didn't call to mind the original. I mean, they can certainly travel really far from the original. One image that doesn't appear in the book is a fashion photo that I found of a woman in some kind of $10,000 Yeti vest and with crazy hair. This was in the New York Times Sunday Magazine a few years ago. And the only thing that marks it as a parody of American Gothic is that they're standing, that there are two women standing next to each other and that one of them is holding a three-tined pitchfork. But that's really, really far from the original, and yet we know what it's sending.
Yeah, you see it and you get it. You definitely get the reference. How did this painting change Grant Wood's life?
Well, it changed it dramatically. As I said, he was unknown before it was painted and was nationally famous within a matter of months after it was reproduced in newspapers. And arguably, he was the most famous and successful American artist of the 1930s, financially to some extent, but certainly critically, widely acclaimed and celebrated as a true, you know, Native American painter. At the same time, there were always critics, but particularly critics coming from the political left in the mid-30s who thought that Wood's paintings, American Gothic and others, were celebratory in a bad way, that they were evading the hard realities of the Great Depression, that if these two figures were supposed to be farmers and that house behind them was supposed to be a farmhouse, that they were far too prosperous for this to be anything even vaguely realistic.
Well, this touches on, and we've talked about it one way or another all through the conversation, about one of the big questions about the painting is, what about it makes it possible for people to look at it and see so many different things? And perhaps there are a lot of paintings like that. But something about this particular painting seems to invite this very wide range of interpretations. And I don't know if there even a way to talk about particular qualities of the picture that make it so open to bringing to it whatever the viewer wants to bring to it.
I think there are. I think that the expressions that he created on these two figures' faces are ambiguous, to say the least. There's a kind of inscrutability about both of them that you don't really know what they're. It's hard to say definitively, this is who these people are and this is what they're thinking and feeling. I think just their faces invite a range of possible interpretations. And then there are things outside the figures, that Gothic window in particular, and as you mentioned, the pitchfork. Wood insisted that this painting was called American Gothic because this was a Gothic window, and that's that. But certainly over the years, people have interpreted Gothic in more expansive ways. And one of the images that I included in the book, one of the illustrations, is of a horror movie, I think a straight-to-video horror movie from the late 80s called American Gothic, where you have Rod Steiger and Yvonne DiCarlo holding bloody knives and a bloody pitchfork and teenagers peering out from that window screaming as they're about to be brutally murdered. So, I mean, that's an extreme case of reading a kind of darkness or haunting quality into this. But I do think that that window, the inscrutability of the expressions, the fact that that there's a curtain on the window, the ambiguous relationship between the two people in the painting, that's invited a range of speculations, a range of perfectly plausible stories about whom these people are and what secrets they might be concealing.
Yeah. There is, I guess, you know, the more you think about it, there is something a little odd about the pitchfork. Although you point out, and in fact you reproduce in the book, a sketch that Grant Wood did, a kind of a study for the painting. We talked about the fact that he first saw the house and he liked that and had the idea that he wanted to use that as a backdrop and pose figures in front of it. And here there's his sketch, his rough sketch of these two figures, man, woman, standing as they are in the painting, and that the man is holding a rake. So clearly he, even at that point, he had this idea of that as a visual element to the picture, and that then when he did the painting, instead of having the rake, he apparently had this hay fork that he, for some particular reason, he liked. But somehow something about it does strike one as being just the tiniest bit odd, or not, I suppose. You know, perhaps there are people who look at the painting and don't think about that at all, and perhaps concentrate most as you might on the faces of the two people who are in the picture.
Well, I think that the cumulative effect of these thousands of parodies, the fact that this painting is now so familiar to almost everybody in this country, at least, means that kind of getting back to the weirdness of it, or the potential weirdness of it, takes some work. One of the things about just seeing it reproduced and seeing other faces plugged into it and other things put into his hand instead of the hay fork, even other backgrounds, is that it's kind of flattened out the original, so that we assume that the original couldn't possibly have had any real edge to it, or a kind of, you know, dark possibilities to it, or satirical possibilities to it. We assume that the original was sort of an earnest, positive portrayal of down-to-earth Americans.
I guess that's an interesting point, particularly when we look at images that we have seen a lot, that we're all been exposed to many times, that it's impossible. I suppose you can try, but it's impossible to go to it as if you have never seen it before. Sort of try to put yourself in this frame of mind that says, I'm going to close my eyes and I'm going to open my eyes and it's going to be as if I'm looking at this for the very first time. What is my immediate clean first impression? It's not something that's possible to do.
It's not possible to do, but I spent a few days just staring at the original and eavesdropping on people's conversations about it at the Art Institute. And I recommend that. It's a good thing to do. You're absolutely right. You can't strip away all the parodies you've seen. You can't really make it entirely unfamiliar to you. But you can, I think, get some reasonably fresh perspectives on it, especially if you see the original. And if you open up your imagination to how other people might have seen it earlier. That's why, as I said, I was so struck by the fact that this really made people angry initially. Mm-hmm. And to try to look at it and to try to imagine how that would have been possible and why that would have been possible, I think is something you can do. But then again, I saw this first as in the form of parodies long before I ever made it to the Art Institute, and I think that's true for most people who aren't native Chicagoans.
Yeah. Our guest is Stephen Biel. He is director of the History and Literature Program at Harvard University. He is author of the book American Gothic, A Life of America's Most Famous Painting, about Grant Wood's picture that's now 75 years old. It's published by the book, published by W.W. Norton. And we have someone here with comments, a question. Others are welcome, by the way, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. The caller is in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to get back to the thing about the pitchfork. Having grown up in farm country and having been around a lot of kind of small farmers, people who would have been like the people depicted in the painting, you know, the pitchfork back in those days was a fairly widely used instrument. I mean, they used it to scoop hay with in the barn. They used it to scoop manure with. So, you know, a theory would be that he included the pitchfork rather than a rake just to show that these people were, in fact, farmers and they weren't city dwellers raking leaves in their backyard.
That's absolutely true. There's no doubt that Wood himself, who was familiar with farm life, it might have just kind of come naturally to him to introduce this as the implement that the man is holding. On the other hand, maybe because of the initial outcry by farm wives, Wood said that these were not supposed to be farmers. They were supposed to be small-town dwellers. And he said that the way that you could tell this was that the man was just dressed too well to actually be doing any physical labor with that hay fork, he's just holding it because, it's a way of asserting his kind of small town credentials, but saying, "But I grew up on a farm," or something like that. But Wood was rather insistent at first, at least, that these were small town people and not farmers. The other thing is that there were artistic conventions, both American and European, of farmers standing in front of their homesteads, holding the tools of their trade. One of the images that is included in the book is a photograph taken by an itinerant photographer in Nebraska in the late 19th century, which is a fairly typical photograph of a farmer or a homesteader and his wife posed in front of their dugout, and he's holding a pitchfork. It doesn't mean that Grant Wood necessarily saw this photo, but he was aware of certain kind of conventions, certain kinds of Midwestern images that had circulated for years before he painted American Gothic.
I had one other comment too, if I might. it seems to me that the painting is so popular and may have spawned so many different interpretations simply because of its blandness. I mean, there's just looking at it on the surface, there's nothing to my mind very remarkable at all in it, or even all that interesting. It's just a man and a woman standing in front of a house with a pitchfork, and you can read a whole lot into that if you choose to.
That's true, but that raises the question. Well, I imagine there are lots of other bland images out there. I do agree with you, though, that part of its ability to be parodied endlessly just has to do with its composition. I mean, it's really easy to cut out those faces and plug in other faces. It's really easy to stick something else in that guy's hand. It's really easy to vary the background. So the fact that it's a portrait, it's these two people that you can pair up two kind of divergent people in this, and that it's easy to do, I think, accounts for a lot of its circulation and endless parodying.
Great. Well, thanks very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Other questions? Somebody wants to get in real quick here with a question, a comment. We have about 5 minutes. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. The Art Institute paid Grant Wood $300 for this painting. What's it worth today?
I don't know that I've seen a particular value to it, but I think it's safe to say a whole lot more than $300.
Yes, I'm sure. It's probably one of those things that you literally have to say is beyond putting a price on. Certainly the Art Institute is not going to sell it.
Right.
But I'm sure that it is one of those, and perhaps there, if you have a museum, you're lucky enough to have some signature works that draw people. I am sure that for the Art Institute, this is one of the big signature works that draw people, and so it's worth it to the museum just because it's one of the things that gets people in the door.
Absolutely, and it sure was a good buy for them.
Pretty good, yeah, $300.
Yeah, yeah,
of course,
yeah.
That was in late 1930. Now, in those days, $300 amounted to some money.
About $3,000 or
okay.
So.
Okay.
Still a good bargain. Yeah.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Savoy, nearby community here, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm born in Iowa and grew up with the controversy of the various things that came out of Grant Wood Studios, and one of them was Daughters of the American Revolution. People were hopping mad about that. And I wondered if you have any comments about that, or have you spent any time looking at it?
I've spent some time looking at it, not nearly as much as I spent with American Gothic, but you're right. That was his second most controversial painting, I would say. It was three very unpleasant-looking women standing in front of a mantelpiece with a image of Washington crossing the Delaware behind them, and it was now there's a case where we do know Wood's intentions, and they were decidedly satirical. He was sending up these self-righteously hyper-patriotic women, and he said that, first of all, he later said that was the least favorite of his among his major paintings.
Do you think that's a cop out?
It might be a cop out. It might be just a change of attitude, because he really over the course of the 30s came to see himself as somebody who was honoring the Middle West and was honoring his subjects, and the idea that I think he became increasingly uncomfortable with the very idea that he was a satirical painter. But there's no doubt that he was. I mean, that's not ambiguous at all. He's making fun of those people.
In American Gothic, my lifelong impression of it has been how well he portrayed how severe life was in the 30s. And I was growing up at that time, so it was severe everywhere.
That's true, and it was seen that way. On the other hand, There were other artists and lots of critics who really laid into Wood for not painting Midwestern rural life in a bleaker way.
I
mean, if you compare this to those photographs that we know so well of the Dust Bowl of refugees from Oklahoma and Arkansas, it seems these people are very prosperous and solid, and they don't seem to be suffering much at all. There's no landscape to speak of in this, but by what we can infer from the barn on the right side and the lush trees on the left side, that these people are doing pretty well. And he took some heat for actually not representing them as not representing the situation as being as hard and difficult as it really was.
We're going to have to leave it there. My apologies for jumping in on the caller, but we've simply come to the end of the time. Our guest is Stephen Beal. He is director of the History and Literature Program at Harvard. His book, American Gothic, is now out in the bookstores. It's published by W.W. Norton. You can see the painting at the Art Institute. And then later on this year, between September 10th and December 4th, it will be on display in the Cedar Rapids Museum of Art. The Art Institute is lending it out so it can go home for a little while. And so you can see it there. Mr. Beal, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Our guest, Stephen Beal. Also, we want to say thanks to the folks at Harvard for being on the other end of this high-quality ISDN connection for us. The broadcast today is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign, locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925. Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio. Focus 580 also made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates. This year, celebrating their 23rd anniversary, Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. That is it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. There's more coming up as part of the afternoon magazine. The show starts now. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up this afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour of the afternoon magazine, we'll take a look inside the U.S. Supreme Court. Our guest will be Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Linda Greenhouse. She covers the court for the New York Times. She's also the author of a new book that examines Harry Blackmun's tenure on the High Court. The title of the book, Becoming Justice Blackmun. Let's turn our attention now to the Chicago Board of Trade, where prices are higher. July wheat trading at 331, up 7 1/4. September 339 1/4, up 6 3/4. July corn 235 3/4, up 8 3/4. September 243 3/4, up 8 1/4. December corn 255, up 8. And March corn 261 3/4, up 7 1/2. July